Proverbs 12, shall we? Let's go there. 12:11. Have you done this one? Lie to me if we have. No? All right.
No.
Read that for me.
Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense.
All right. So, idea being that he who obviously works hard is going to have what at the end of the, you know, again, agrarian culture. What do they get to reap at the end of this time?
Man.
Yeah, they get their stuff, right? They get fruit. They get the rewards of their labor, okay? However, he who pursues worthless things lacks sense. I think there's kind of an interesting note maybe in today's culture. It's kind of this get rich quick. Man, that's a lot of words this early in the morning. Idea. And as you think about those and maybe have seen those, they've been around for a long time. And, you know, anywhere you look, there's the idea of, hey, you don't have to work hard, but you can make a ton of money. Those are out there. The reality is there are very few people that, you know, work 30 minutes a week and make $1 million doing it, right? It just does not happen. Most people that are going to make it in the world do it because they work hard. They are diligent. They put their hands to the task, and they are willing to pursue that with vigor. The same proverb is mentioned again in Proverbs 28:19. And then, where was my cross-reference? Sorry, I had to find it. Turn to 24, Proverbs 17:24. This is a interesting correlation to this one.
Which one?
17:24. Let me read that.
Discerning set his face toward wisdom, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth.
Wisdom, mine says, is in the presence of the one who has understanding, but the eyes of the fool are on the ends of the earth. What does that mean? What is the comparison there? Wisdom is in the presence of the one who has understanding, but the eyes of the fool are on the ends of the earth. What's that talking about?
Like they're always looking for the next thing, the next great thing that can, yeah.
Yeah. You ever met someone like that? They're always talking about what they're going to do one day, but yet they can't pay their bills, right? They can't. You know, when you go take them out to lunch, you're buying. They're trying to figure out how to save up for ramen. They can't live in reality. They can't get a job and work hard and save and, you know, be independent. But boy, they have grandiose dreams that are so big. And that's great and all, right? There's nothing wrong with dreams and saying, man, one day I want to do this. And, you know, those are fantastic things. So long as you don't live in those pie-in-the-sky ideas, as long as you don't live there, right, in this pretend world, that's fine. The Bible continues to exalt the person who works hard, is willing to do the difficult labor day in and day out without immediate reward, right? That's basically what, you know, the illustration that Solomon uses for farming, right? That's the idea of, man, you have to sow, and you have to prepare your ground, and you have to do all these things, and there's no immediate return on your investment. But if you don't do them, you don't end up with a crop, right? That is an exalted idea. As you guys think through one of the qualities that are exalted of women in Proverbs 31, which what comes to mind, speaking of this proverb?
Before the sun and goes to bed.
Doing what?
Working.
Working, right? Hard work is a beautiful thing, okay, for men and for women. But part of that is a piece of the equation, okay? So as you guys think about dreams and think about doing great things in the future, don't give those up. Those are fantastic. But make sure you're able to live in reality and do the things necessary to get there, okay? There's nothing more frustrating than watching people bounce from thing to thing to thing to thing because they can't commit and they can't stay in and they won't do the difficult stuff. Okay, we've all been around people like that work is beneath them or whatever it may be. Okay, whatever God has called you to, do it and do it with excellence and move forward in your aspirations and your desires, and those are ultimately great things to achieve. But make sure that you can't that you balance that with a bit of the here and now. Okay, and again, wisdom is at the hand presently in front of those who are wise. The fool is the one that they just can't quite grasp it. All right, so cool thoughts, pushback, ideas, ramblings. All right, back to Numbers. Let me pray, and then we will about to dive back into the text. God, thanks for today, for a new morning, to enjoy you and just to be in your presence. Father, as we study your text and see what a hard part of the Israelites' journey out of Egypt and the way you have disciplined them, and as we see kind of them boil over and all the junk that's on the inside come out, I pray that you continue to teach us lessons, be with our hearts as we are here, and help us again, Father, just to draw closer to you in these moments. We love you. In Christ's name, amen. All right, so if you had to summarize what we're seeing out of this generation, this first generation of people, give me some descriptors, if you will. Yeah, they're complainers, for sure, absolutely. What else have you seen?
They want to go back.
Absolutely, right? So much so that in 14 they were getting ready to pick a new leader and say, the heck with Moses, right? We're out of here and we're going to take someone else with us to take us back to Egypt.
I feel bad for Moses. I mean, he's just like points where he's just like on point, but then he's like human.
Yeah, I mean, right? You're going to feel worse for him this morning. I mean, I think there's this journey that you watch Moses go on and you realize, I think if we're honest, if I was in his shoes, what would I have done, right? And where would my patience have broken? And it would have broken far before his. He seems to do everything right. And he's going to make one poor decision and respond in the flesh in just a moment. And it's like, boy, grand scheme of things, it doesn't feel like that big a deal. And God says, Moses, now you're on the bench. He's like, oh, man, really, God? So, yeah, you definitely feel for the guy. Because, I mean, think about that in terms of God's call, maybe to you in ministry. Man, here's a guy that just got a hard job, and he's doing exactly what God calls him to do, and yet there's no great results. He doesn't convert a generation, right? They start bad and end worse, and that is exactly what God wanted for him. It's said of Jeremiah, there was not one convert during his entire ministry of being a prophet. That was his job. Go be an evangelist. And I think it was like 80 years. Not one person is recorded to convert. He does his job, tells people about Christ or God, and does exactly what he's supposed to do. And zero fruit from his ministry. Okay, so interesting that God calls some of us just to, man, just labor. Just keep laboring. And that's one of the difficult things about ministry is we don't always get to see. And this is what was created, right? That's one of the frustrations. We just don't always get to see results. So, in ministry specifically, you have to find other wins, right, to hang your hat on and say, man, that was great. So, something to consider. So, yeah. Moses has got a tough job. What else?
Seems like the group is pretty varied in, like, their beliefs and leadership.
Yeah, for sure. And in a group like that, that's why it's so important that when that rabble starts barking, for all the people that were on the fence, that was just what they needed to get pushed over. They needed one person to start stirring the pot, right? And then they got in with it. So, good observation. Okay?
Yeah, you would think when they got killed that they'll jump back over the fence, you know, kind of be like, oh, yeah, there's a God.
And that's what's amazing about what we're going to read this morning. You see the consequences continue to get ramped up, and people are like, we're going to continue, I mean, just like blindly into our sin. They will not repent. So much so that I was looking at the order of stuff this morning and thought, surely this had to happen. This is like out of chronological order. And some of the stuff we look at may be, but boy, it's just, it's disheartening to see how hard these people are, okay? So we saw the beginnings of that really yesterday, right? We saw in chapter 11, the people coming out of the wilderness. We saw the rabble start barking, right? That moved into Miriam and Aaron, okay? We're going to look at 13 this morning, which is when the spies were sent out. And we'll kind of get a piece of that puzzle. In 14 is kind of where we left off yesterday. And really, in one sense, this is the climactic event of what their grumblings come to. And then in 16, it's going to get worse. And I think 16 probably occurs, I think, somewhere before, I think, the events of maybe 14. Okay, because 14 seems to be, in a sense, so severe that it would be amazing that... anyway, we'll look at it, okay? So let's do this. Let's return to 13, okay? So chronologically, we've seen the grumblings. We've seen the issue with Miriam and Aaron and their trying to usurp the authority of Moses, and we've seen kind of those pieces happen. And then as they roll into the land and as they're doing kind of their journey through the wilderness, they stop at a place called Kadesh Barnea. Okay, Kadesh Barnea is going to be home base for the Israelites for 38 years. Okay, as they're wandering in the wilderness, this is primarily where they're going to stay. So they get out of Egypt, they camp here for a long time, they go in and out from here, but this is kind of the... this is kind of it. This is in the southernmost portion of the Negev. It's right on the southern border of the Promised Land. Okay, they're still in the wilderness. It's still miserable. But it's not as if the people are like, where do we go? It's like right there. Okay, it's like driving north on the 99 coming into Fresno. It's like, yeah, there's downtown. I can see it. It's not a great mystery as to where it is. God just said, I am not permitting you to go in. Okay, so they're there. So, in context, that's kind of the piece, okay? Moses has the idea in chapter 13 to say, listen, let's go spy out the land. Let's go figure out what's here. They know they're going to go, but Moses is being wise and shrewd, just like he was with his boy Hobab. That's a great name, by the way. I dare someone to name your kid Hobab. And he's trying to be wise with that, okay? So his strategy in verses basically 4 and following is he picks a dude from each tribe, okay? So they're going to send in 12 guys to go spy out the land. You guys have all studied this in Sunday school, so you've heard the story. And there are two guys specifically that that we need to bring to the attention of all of us, okay? 13 verse 6, we get Caleb. He is from Judah. Okay, that's his tribe. And then obviously we get Joshua in verse 16, the son of Nun. These are the two guys that are going to bring back a favorable report. Okay, what they see is great. They're overwhelmed, and we'll look at that. But the rest of the tribe members that go, the heads of each of the other tribes, say, man, this is a bad idea. Okay, and we'll find out why here in a second. Okay, so let's look at... I'm going to pick up in 17, and this is Moses' command once he's rallied the 12.
Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up into the Negev and go up into the hill country and see what the land is and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad, and whether the cities that they dwell in are camps or strongholds, and whether the land is rich or poor, or whether there are trees in it or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes.
All right, so probably in the summer, time for harvest, okay? And Moses says, go in. Look at everything, the people, the land, the trees, like... give me an idea of what we're up against when we go in. Okay, God's going to let them go into the land, but it's not like, this isn't like Jericho where he's just going to cause walls to fall down and everyone in the land is just going to run and die, right? They've got to go in and battle for the land. So Moses is being wise, saying, let's have a strategy as we go in. Okay, so this is a very smart idea. Okay, 21, they go in. And again, they're on the southern end of just the land, so they're going to go north up into the Negev. So they're traveling through the wilderness. Okay, you guys are going to walk that same path. Okay, really cool. One of my favorite parts and most people's highlights of the trip is kind of our walk through the Negev. It's really, really powerful. And then they're going to go north up into the land. Okay, they're going to go to the coast. They're going to go up into the mountains. They're going to go in the Shephelah. They're going to check out, right? They're going to get a good lay of the land. Okay, 21, wilderness of Zin. Okay. As far as Rahab, we're not exactly sure where that place is, but somewhere in the southern Negev as well, okay? Verse 22, they had come up to Negev. They came to Hebron. Hebron is kind of south of Jerusalem, big picture. I'd show you on our fabulous projector that we don't have, but it's coming. So you'll get that soon, all right? So they go and explore all these places, okay? 23, look at what they come up with. In fact, 22... look at, just before you go there, look at who's in the land. The descendants of Anak were there. Who are the Anak?
Is that Nephilim?
Yeah, that may be a reference to some of the giants. So they literally see giants in the land. These guys, it says the Nephilim were destroyed, in chapter 6 or 9 of Genesis, however long ago that was. But apparently there's some remnant around of some giant group of people, okay? Obviously, we're going to see it with Goliath, right? We're going to see this dude is 9 feet plus tall. So there's some type of, big guys that are, when you think about that, that's a 10-foot ceiling, right? That is a large man that, when you have to duck underneath the door jamb and, So you would rightly fear for your life, okay? So they apparently are in that land, okay? 23, here's the fruit of the land.
And they came to the valley of Eshcol and cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes. And they carried it on a pole between two of them. They also brought some pomegranates and figs.
All right, so pretty significant harvest when you're carrying a single cluster of grapes between two poles. Right? You can carry a cluster of grapes in your hand. These are large grapes, okay? So in case you weren't clear on that, these are big, okay? So whether that's a bit of a hyperbole or not, I don't know, but it sounds like that's pretty legit, okay? 25, they return from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, so they've been all over. They come back. They come tell Moses and Aaron, all the congregation, what they have seen in the wilderness of Paran and at Kadesh, okay, or Kadesh Barnea. They brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So initially, there's excitement. Hey, we went in. We did this. It does. Indeed, verse 27, it is a land flowing with milk and honey, just as God said. Problem is, 28, the people who live in the land are strong. Their cities are fortified. They're very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Okay, when we were in Israel a couple years ago, Rich Ferreira brought a guy with him named Sam, who was an Old Testament professor at Ohio State University. Crazy guy. He's like a walking Bible, okay? He made the observation that they saw, when they went into the land, the fortified cities and all these things, but the people were distinct. They were gone at this point. Like, they had moved to another geographical area. So they saw maybe descendants, but they saw what they had built and the size of everything, and they feared because of that. Now, he's got some, like, agricultural whatever that he studied based on crazy how he came up with the idea. So I don't know for sure, but at the very least, they saw structures. They saw things that these giants would have lived in, and they panicked, and they may have indeed seen actual giants. We don't know for sure. It seems like, obviously, in the land, there are these type of people, but he made the observation of, man, they panicked over really nothing, okay? And they just saw, like, a large house with big ceilings, and they thought, oh, there could be giants, and, oh, we shouldn't go, right? So, regardless, these guys give a bad report. They basically say, man, yes, the land is great. However, there's a downside, okay? Verse 30, look who steps up and says, hey, listen, we're not going to cower down to this.
Verse
what? 30. Hi. Nice to meet you.
But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it.
All right, so Caleb is the one guy, really the two guys. Joshua does the same. We don't see him speak as strongly, but he's in cahoots with Caleb here that they should go up. Okay, so yeah, there is a downside, but we're not going to allow that to dissuade us from going into the land, okay? And we're going to see both Joshua and Caleb rewarded later when the old generation is called to the carpet. These two guys are kind of set aside saying, man, they are not of this faithless generation, okay? 31, the people's response, surprise, surprise, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out the sons of Israel a bad report of the land. And I guess it really wasn't necessarily a bad report. The report was accurate. The problem was the fact that they lacked the faith to go in to do what God had told them to do. So, you know, here are the graves, here's the lay of the land. They gave a decent report. The fear that inside them drove them more than their faith in God. Okay, so just as a backdrop, I know we've kind of fast-forwarded already. 13, they've seen the land. They know it's coming. They know God has called them to go in, and their lack of faith that characterizes them as a generation makes them panic, and they say, we shouldn't do this. Okay? So, yeah.
Do you know about what time this was, like within the 40 years?
Yeah. This is right at the beginning. So we're talking about their... in 14, when we see the cursing of this generation, I think they're 37 and a half years left of their journey. So we're talking about 2.5 years at the most since they've left Egypt. Probably a little bit less than that. The journey isn't actually 40 years. It's like 38 and a half or something. I forget. So anyway, so we're talking at most 2.5 years. And they've been sitting in Mount Sinai for a year. So yeah, there's still a lot of time left in the wilderness. God's basically going to say, because of your lack of faith, I'm going to take a year for every day that you spied out the land, 40 years. Okay, so that's their punishment. That's why it's the 40 years in the wilderness doing laps. Okay, so we'll see that in 14. Okay, so that is what was the event that said, hey, let's go back, let's fire Moses, let's find a new guy, and let's go back to Egypt. Okay, and there was nothing more offensive than basically them saying to God, we're done with you, we're done with your provision. In fact, we're going to go worship other gods back in Egypt, and we want to make sure our bellies are full. So that was the thing that caused God to say, okay, we're finished with them. Okay, we saw Moses' phenomenal speech saying, hey, God, your reputation's at stake, right? We don't want the people to be, or you to be laughed at as a result of the people dying in the wilderness. And he basically pleads with God all the way through chapter 14 to forgive the people. In 18, he reminds God, 14, 18, of his own characteristics that God is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving. And he reminds God of all these things, okay? And in verse 20, this is God's answer. So look at 14:20. This is where God ends up with this generation.
Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of God, none of the men who have seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and I have not obeyed, and not have not obeyed my voice, shall see the land that I swore to give to their fathers, and none of those who despise me shall see it.
All right, so he says, I'm forgiving them, okay? Verse 20, I have pardoned them according to your word, okay? So I forgive them. However, there are consequences to their action. They are not going into the land. By no means will I let anybody who has put me to the test these 10 times, okay? God seems to be referring to, as you start adding up, when they left Egypt, and you start looking at the issues of food and water, and they're complaining as you add them up, there's 10-ish things. And he says, I'm done. All they have done is complain. That's clearly what they want to do. The straw that broke the camel's back is them wanting to go back to Egypt. We are not going to do it. Okay. I forgive them, but there's consequences. Okay. However, verse 24, my servant Caleb, because he has brought back a different spirit or has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he has entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Okay. He mentions Joshua at some point, but the assumption is both these guys get to go in. Verse 30, there it is. Surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to you, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. So those are the two men of the old generation that go into the land. Everyone else is going to die, okay? Men, women, everybody, okay? It's a disaster, okay? So bad time. So that's kind of the picture that he paints. So consequences to their sin and their disbelief, and that's kind of the that's the straw that broke the camel's back for God, okay? Yeah.
So it's everyone of the old generation, so that's not including the children or anything, right?
No, the children will be the ones that get to go in, okay? So for whatever reason, it seems like they draw a line in the sand at 20. That's how they count the men and the women. So if you were 20 years old or older when they left for the promised land, when you during the Exodus, you're characterized as part of that old generation, and you're going to die in the wilderness. So, crazy. I'll show you some numbers here in a minute. It's frightening.
So why didn't the people leave?
Why didn't they leave?
Yeah, like so right after the first section of 14.
I would imagine this comes pretty quick on the heels of that, and God speaks, and he's going to speak now to them. Yeah, I imagine they just didn't quite have time to get their leader appointed or whatever process, but I think God had enough and puts an end to that whole idea quickly. So look at verse 26, and now this is God speaking yet again in regards to this situation.
And the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, how long shall this wicked congregation grumble against me? I have heard the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against me. Say to them, as I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing I will do to you. Your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness, and of all your number listed in the census from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me.
You're all going to die. And that's the idea. I've heard you. You barked. I'm listening. That's what you want. From 20 years up, you're all going to die. Okay? And again, the two that are called out, Joshua and Caleb, don't go. 31, your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. Okay, so your kids because they are not a faithless generation, they get to go in. But as for you, verse 32, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness. 33, your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness. They shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until the corpses lie in the wilderness, according to the number of days which you spied out the land. 40 days, for every day you will bear the guilt a year, even 40 years, and you shall know my opposition. So God says, I am basically opposed to this. Now, they put down, again, a couple years already, it looks like, so it won't be 40 from here. But if you did the math on 40, just think about this, okay? If you have to have, on a safe estimate, 1.2 million people die, right? Over the course of 37 and a half years. That is 32,000 people a year that would need to die. Okay, that's 87 people a day that would need to die. Okay, 3.65 funerals an hour. That means somebody's dying every 15 minutes. If you did that on a 24-hour period, okay? If people only died during waking hours, that's 7 funerals every hour. Can you imagine? Like every 8.5 minutes. I mean, just people like dying. Everybody would be unclean. Good observation. God's going to solve that as well. Okay, that's insane. Every 8 minutes, someone's going to die.
This might be a weird question, but do they like bury them in the sand?
Yeah.
It's not sand though. It's not that kind of desert.
It's no. I think they just kind of are left to their corpses are going to rot in the wilderness. So.
They like burn them or anything?
Not ideal. Conditions to see a grave out there.
No, there's not a lot of digging to do. It's rock, so this is not a... It's like trying to dig in a Fresno hard pan, but worse. So you're not... No. So, again, part of the consequences.
So they would
have... Go ahead.
In verse 31 where it says that their little ones who you said would become prey.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Prey to what? Like, are there animals? Are there...
Prey to the conditions. We're all going to die based on, there's no food, there's no what. We're prey, right? Okay. We're all going to die. Okay. So.
I didn't know if, like, there were animals with, like...
There were, but I don't think that's what it's referring to. Okay. So, yeah, we see in the wilderness not too much. Most of the stuff that was dangerous was in up in the land and better. Okay. You know, we see the bears, we see lions later. Okay. Yeah, but not in the wilderness. So, okay. So, lots of death. Okay. So, not a good picture. Okay. But they're all going to go down.
These people weren't necessarily not dying of, like, old age. They were just dying.
Just dying. Yeah. Of a curse. So, yeah. Can you imagine just wandering and just knowing I'm going to die and you're watching people die and knowing that you're just, are you next? Are you in the next 10 minutes? Are you, right? You get another 3 years, but you're going to die.
Why didn't it all just fall apart? Like, why didn't they just try to leave? Or, like, why did they continue following the group if they knew that?
Yeah, I don't know. That's, the way back would have been still hard and they were without water and food. If someone doesn't lead them, they don't. They're going to die in the wilderness if they leave. So they're kind of in between a rock and a hard place. God wouldn't allow them to go into the land, which would have been, you know, at this point, the shortest deal. But their journey is going to be crazy. They're right on the edge of the land, and God doesn't let them go in. They have to go way down south, make a U-turn, and then come up the east side because they crossed the Jordan, remember, on the east side of the Jordan where Jacob did. So they try to go through some land, and God says, no, I'm not going to permit it. So much so that he raises up foes that threaten to kill them if they step foot on their land. And it's going to be from our buddy Esau and his descendants in Edom that are the primary, like, do not step foot on our land. So, or we're coming with war in mind. So, yeah, they're in a tough spot because they're going to die if they leave with food or water issues. Okay? So, that's the idea, all right? Now, here is the obstinance of this people, okay? Here is the response. God just told them, you're all going to die, okay? Keep that as a backdrop, okay? Verse 39, Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, and the people greatly mourned. Like, okay, good start. Keep going, Layla, verse 40. 1440.
And they rose early in the morning and went up to the heights of the hill country, saying, here we are. We will go up to the place that the Lord has promised, for we have sinned.
Huh?
But Moses...
What? Oh, we repent. No, we're good. We're sorry. We're going to go ahead and go in now. Really? Keep going.
But Moses said, why now are you transgressing the commands of the Lord when that will not succeed?
Do not go up, for the Lord is not among you, lest you be struck down before your enemies.
That's a scary thought. Do not go up. The Lord is not among you. Like, don't go. Verse 44, they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant, nor the Lord, nor Moses left the camp. I mean, how do you think that's going to end? When they leave camp, Moses says, whoa, whoa, whoa. Bad idea. Thanks for your false words of confession that are meaningless. And you're leaving camp, and the cloud is sitting there right above the tabernacle. Moses is hanging out in there. The Ark's still there. And they're like, no, 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 we're going to go. It's all good. Like, you know that 45 is not a good picture.
It kind of seems like the whole community is being punished because 10 guys. Is that true, or is it just that's what their hearts are?
No, they are all. Okay. I mean, it seems like to a man, a faithless generation.
So even though they didn't necessarily make the decision, that's where their hearts were.
Yeah, that's exactly where their hearts were. So yeah, they all wanted to go back. So
I was just thinking that this looks kind of like, this is an example, when I have a 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old niece, and my 3-year-old niece, when she gets in trouble and when she gets sent to timeout, once she's in timeout, she'll be like, okay, I'm ready to listen. We're like, that's nice.
Yeah.
You're going to stay in timeout,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. 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 It's funny, and that's a great, I don't know about in your life, but that's a great measuring rod in mine. Do I fear breaking a relationship with God more, or do I fear more the consequences that may come as a result of my stupidity? And that's a great mark for a hard heart or a soft heart, or, you know, so I think about that in the back of my mind as well, right? You know, and we're all the same way. We're all wired like 3-year-olds to some degree of, so that's their issue. They don't really care. They just want their bellies full, and they want what they want. They're not concerned that they disobeyed God. They're concerned that God took away, you know, their cookie and the good things that they, you know, the vending machine that God is to them. God says that's not how this works, okay? So 45, sure enough, the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in the hill country came down, struck them, and beat them as far as Hormah. So there's a whole bunch of people that go up, not all of them, but there's a whole bunch of people that get spanked right there, okay? So that's the idea.
Is that how we killed a bunch of them?
Yeah, that took care of a few right there. We don't get a number, but yeah, we're still going to get a bunch more that die. But there's a group that certainly is easy prey. Okay?
That would be a discouragement for leaving
together.
Right? Is what happened.
Yeah. Chapter 15, now we need to start reviewing, okay? We don't, but the new generation needs to hear a bit more of the sacrificial system. So 15 through 21 is more about all the way through the wanderings. We're going to teach some of this. We won't skip it all. But chapter 15 is primarily stuff that we've read before that's now being communicated again to the younger generation with them as the focus. So stuff about sacrifices, random kind of things in here, but it's more of God's sacrificial system and reminding the young generation what it's like. We see a couple things in here that weren't mentioned in Leviticus. We've talked about them before, but the drink offering is mentioned in this text. Is it the wave offering that's mentioned as well? Anyway, so there's a couple reiterations of that, and then they're going to get the whole book of Deuteronomy just to make sure they have it down really, really well. Okay. He reminds them in verse 17 of what's to come when they get in the land. Look at 15, 18 and following.
Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land to which I bring you, and when you eat of the bread of the land, you shall present a contribution to the Lord.
Okay, so they're going to make offerings, but what does that imply? What's going to end when they come into the land?
The manna.
The manna, right? So there's a time that you're going to come into the land, God's going to shut off that valve, and you are going to eat the production of the land that you did nothing to earn, right? You didn't plant it, you didn't grow it, you didn't water it, you didn't tend it. The pagans did, and you're going to come in, whoop them, and eat their food. So he reminds them, that's how this is going to work. So don't forget, we'll see this repeated again, don't forget me in the process, right? You're going to walk into a land where you have everything, right? Here's your Porsche and your Maserati and your mansion, and everything is laid out for you, and it's just given to you. Don't forget God in the process, okay? So that's the idea. Okay, so he reminds them of a few things, tells them that. You guys remember the story that we mentioned earlier and about the guy gathering wood on the Sabbath? That's here in verse 32, okay? Israel was in the wilderness. They found a guy literally out working on the Sabbath who knew better. They find him, bring him to God. Moses says, Lord, what do you want to do with this guy? And God's answer in verse 35 is that man surely shall be put to death, and all the congregation shall stone him with stones. So when I say rest and honor God on the Sabbath, and you're working instead of honoring God, that was the consequence. So stern consequence for this guy, but that's the idea, okay?
Is that normal that they were just walking around and they come across a man?
Yeah, I mean, there
were there people out there?
Well, this would have been one of their own. This is someone from their congregation.
Oh,
yeah.
Was like,
yeah. Random people out there? Yeah. No. Just kill them. Our God said, "Don't gather wood on the Sabbath," so we're going to kill you. I was like, no. This is one of the Israelites. Okay. 38 and following has kind of an, I don't know, it'll make sense today as you kind of come into Israel, but this is why it's here. I have no idea chronologically why God would insert it in Numbers, but it's fascinating as you see the garb of an Israelite today. Look at 37 and following.
The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue on the tassel of each corner. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. So you shall remember and do all of my commandments and be holy to your God."
All right, so God tells them in their dress, they are to have certain things on their garments. And what were the purpose of these tassels and things that he asked them to put on their garments? To remember God, okay? It's probably not the best illustration, but like a rosary where you have something tactile to hold on to while you're thinking about God. When we go to Israel, you'll see people with prayer shawls, okay? And some of them will wear them underneath their clothes, and you'll see these tassels made of, like, cord that have a certain amount of knots in them. Okay, there's 5 knots for the 5 books of Moses, and there's all the symbolism as to how they put them together. And when they pray, sometimes they'll touch those, and they're to remember the law of God is to not break his laws. It's fascinating.
So if he's giving them all these laws and stuff and, like, telling them when they get into the land, isn't he kind of, like, trusting the old generation to teach the new generation?
And Moses. So, oh, yeah. Okay. So primarily I think Moses is the vehicle, and Aaron and, and so forth.
It kind of seems like that would almost be, like, why the book of Deuteronomy is almost written is probably because their parents didn't teach them the law.
Yeah.
So Moses is going to teach them by giving them the new law.
Yeah, so think about that in context of Deuteronomy 6. What is the huge charge to the generation? You guys remember the Shema?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the end of that is mandating that one generation teach the next generation, right? If they don't do their job, then in 3 generations, you're going to have a generation that watched one generation without any instruction or heart behind it, and they're going to follow these rules, and at some point they're going to say, the heck with this, they're going to go crazy, and then they're going to raise a generation that knows nothing of God and has no rules, and now 2 generations away, it's chaos. Okay, that's called the book of Judges. That's exactly what happened. The generation that goes in the land fails to do a good job of raising up the next generation, communicating godliness, and they just, you know, as great as their intentions were, they still fail in that area. And then you end up in Judges with no king in the land, and it says the people did what was right in their own eyes. There was no North Star, law, God, righteous, right? It just went away. So, scary. Okay. 37 and 38, again, with this tassels and stuff, are kind of this obscure deal. There's a fascinating connection that I didn't make, but someone made that I thought was really cool. There is a, that word tassels in verse 38 in corners are both kind of interesting. The word corners there can be translated like the corner of a garment, right? Like the end of a shirt or whatever. It can also be translated the word wing, okay? Like a bird, okay? And when they would pray, they would hold up their prayer shawl and sometimes would hold it out, and you would have this thing that literally looked like a wing. And they would come underneath it like this and pray and go to their prayer closet, by the way, which is what that came from. Anyway, so in Malachi chapter 4, okay, there is a prophecy that the Son of Righteousness will come with healing in his wings. It's the same word, it's the word kanaf, okay? So the idea would be that there would be Some believe that that prophecy would literally mean that there would be a Messiah figure to come who would have healing in his wings or in the corner of his garments. Okay, you guys remember the story in, it's in Luke 8 and Mark chapter 4, of the woman that had the bleeding issue, right? And she touches Jesus, and Jesus stops and says that he's in the crowd, and he says, wait, who touched me? And he's in a crowd. You're like, dude, everyone's touching you, right? You're in the midst of a crowd. That's what happens. And Jesus says, no, something happened. So I felt the power go out of me, or something really cryptic like that. This gal touched the corner of Jesus' garment, and he said, she believes something. She believes Malachi 4, and the reason she touched my garment is because she thinks I'm the Messiah, and hence have healing in my wings. And he stops and acknowledges her and her faith, and she's healed. It's really cool. So with that in mind, go reread Luke 8, verse 42 and following, or Mark 5, 25. That story is both there. But it brings a cool Old Testament context where you go, oh, that's where she got that idea. And that's why Jesus stops and says, wow, your faith is great. Okay?
Do you know what verse it is in Malachi 4?
Malachi 4, 1 and 2, I think. So, yeah, look at those. Mark 5, 25, I think is where it starts. In Luke 8, 4, 24, one of them doesn't give the details of how long she had been with this hemorrhage. I forget how long it was. Like, long, right? Yeah, something like that. So, anyway, so just kind of a fun back. Again, that's kind of where sometimes the New Testament paints color, the old paints color on the new that we don't necessarily have and see. But I thought that was a phenomenal observation. Okay? Now, 16. As we talk about, okay, the ring of grumbling, this is the inside ring. And I think this happens chronologically before chapter 15, certainly. I don't know if it happens before 14, okay? It looks like the congregation's at Kadesh Barnea, so it's after the spies have gone out. Whether it's before or after, God says, listen, you're all going to die. I'm leaving you here in the wilderness. Your kids are going to go in. I don't know. It feels like, based on what God says in 14, that what's happening in 16 wouldn't happen, but these people are so hard-hearted and rebellious, I don't know, like maybe this is their action plan, but I just want you guys to think through it in those inner rings. This is the bullseye of complaining. Like, we thought it was pretty bad with Miriam and Aaron, it gets worse, okay? So 16:1, okay, read that, and let's see what's happening.
Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and...
Sorry, dude, I killed you. So all these guys, you get Byram, you get Reuben. So he takes these initials. There's three dudes, okay, that are going to speak. So Jared, keep going until I'll save you.
And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, remember now.
Okay, what does this sound like? What do you call this?
War.
This is a coup, right? So they three guys, they rally 250 guys, right? Who are the 250?
Chiefs.
These are not like rabble. These are leaders amongst the people. So you've got 253 guys that say, Moses, we're about to take issue with you, okay? A bunch of dudes. They are men of renown. These are leaders in the land. Maybe even of the 70 that Moses chose originally, the same description is used of those guys. I don't know. Probably not. But anyway, that level of leadership, okay? And here's what they have to say in verse 3.
They assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you have gone far enough, for all of the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?
Ooh. Okay, so what is their argument? What are they frustrated with?
That Moses is exalting himself.
Yeah, right? Now what's the one thing that you've seen Moses continually not do?
Himself.
He doesn't care, right? Isn't that fascinating? Like, he doesn't want the spotlight, but he continues to get accused of wanting the spotlight. And regardless of how many times he says, I don't care, it's not about me. Joshua, why are you jealous for my sake? I wish everyone in the congregation would pray and prophesy, right? Like, that's not what I'm looking for. He continues to get accused of it over and over and over again, okay? The real issue with these guys is We want power. We don't want to follow you. We're tired of being in the wilderness, so we're raising a coup against you, and we're going to find the leaders that we asked for in 14, possibly. Here they are, right? So we're now going to leave, okay? Now, for those of you that are astute, 16:1, who are the people involved in this? Okay, you see Reuben, you see Dan. Who is Korah, the son of Kohath?
Oh, he's a priest.
There you go. What kind of priest? What is Kohath do, or a Kohathite? What was their job? They were the guys that got the ark, the utensils. Okay, so think about this. This is Moses' cousin. Okay, he is a. These are the grandsons of Levi. Okay, this guy is leading rebellion. Korah is from the Kohathites. He had arguably, second to Moses and maybe Aaron and his sons, the coolest job in all of Israel, right? As you talk about a true, like, number two person that's not a number one, but they have the, you know, the raddest job description of anybody. They get to carry the, everybody envied these guys. You could touch the ark, you have, nobody else gets to do that. There's like a, not even the Levites, it's a select family of people. Everybody would have looked at these guys and said, yes, you are as high up the tree as you can get, second to being Moses himself, right? This is the guy that's leading that rebellion. So keep that in mind as you're thinking about who is barking and what Moses is accusing them of, okay?
So that explains how he gets those chiefs then.
Exactly. These are not low-level people. This is a coup of coups, right? This is the vice president turning on the president and taking the whole cabinet, the Senate, the House, and saying, you're getting impeached. This is not like us going, we don't like this. This is legit, okay? This is a hostile takeover, if you will, okay?
It sounds like how churches are.
Exactly, right? That if you guys have ever been a part of a church split or whatever, it's there's not a whole lot. It's more nasty, and that's exactly what's happening. Fortunately or fortunately, God steps in this case. He doesn't step in church splits, but yeah, they're, or to my knowledge, he hasn't. So, I'll tell you the story later. It's a nasty situation, okay? So they're accused of exalting themselves. Look at Moses' response. Verse 4.
When Moses heard this, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who he is and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself.
Do you see how many times the Lord, his, him, himself, and he are mentioned in that text? All right, you guys think you're it? Let's let God decide. Tomorrow, he will decide who is holy. He will decide himself, right? Not me and not you. We'll see, okay? You get the idea in verse 4, by the way. Moses falls on his face. It's an act of humility, right? There's this, the sense of that's how you communicate with God. Okay, so here's what they're going to do in verse 6. This is Moses' suggestion.
Do this. Take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi.
That was cussing in the Old Testament, by the way. You sons of Levi. So don't ever say it to someone. It's inappropriate. So what is the plan? What are they doing? What does it mean to take censers, put them in the fire? Who does that? The priest, and the priest only, right? You want to be a priest? You want to be in charge? Fantastic. Get a censer, get your shovel, go to the altar, burn your sacrifice, take the ashes from the sacrifice, go mix your ingredients upon it, bring your censer outside, okay? Aaron will do the same. You 250 or 253, you stand here and do this. Aaron will stand over here and we'll let God choose. Fair? That sounds fair. If you guys are the guys and everyone's holy, if you think everyone is indeed holy, then surely God will acknowledge that. So they're going to have a priest off. Okay, 253, verse 1. And let's see how it goes. Okay, that's exactly what they're doing right now. Okay, and he says, you've gone far enough, you sons of Korah, right? And then I want you to, this is just such a, man, if they were the least bit soft-hearted, I want you to hear Moses' rebuke at 8, 9, and 10. It is stern, but yet Man, you can feel Moses, just he wishes they would repent and wish they understood what they were doing. 8, 9, and 10. Someone read that.
Moses also said to Korah, "Now listen, you Levites. Isn't it enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the Israelite community and brought you near himself to do the work at the Lord's tabernacle and to stand before the community and minister to them? He has brought you and all your fellow Levites near himself, but now you are trying to get the priesthood too."
Listen to that. Like, is it not enough that God has exalted you above all of your brothers and you get to minister to the people, right? But your appetite is insatiable. You will not be content with what God has provided. Are you seeking the priesthood also, right? You get the idea that even if they had that, they're still not going to be satisfied. So I love that response. And for a guy just in my world that has been, God has called me in my life, or at least in my ministerial career, to always be a number two. I'm not wired to be a number one. That's not my primary gifting. Some of you guys that are going into full-time ministry, that's exactly what God has for you, right? But there's not that many of those, right? There's only so many CEOs and presidents and senior pastors and directional leaders. Like, that's just not for everybody. On teams, there's always a leader and then there's a team, right? And it's tempting to say, if I'm not that person in that role, to feel a sense of jealousy, to feel a sense of, well, I should be that. Well, I've got better ideas than her. Or if I had this job, I would do this different than him. And to remember where God has you is significant and purposeful and according to your gifting. And I think in our own insecurities and in my own insecurities, I had to wrestle with this for a long time to think, well, this is where you want me. This is where my gifting is. This is how you've wired me. And I need not to be like this person or that person. I need to be me, and I need to express those values, right? So that's... This was a great learning lesson for me in the midst of seasons of difficulty in my life where I wrestled with, God, what's my fit and where do you want me? And am I jealous of people for the wrong reasons? Or am I being jealous of people and not acknowledging what you've given me or what have you? And that's Moses' very gentle, I think, backhand slap for them. I don't think he's pointing his finger like this when he's saying that. He's like, oh, you just don't get it. God has given you so much. And here you think, I'm trying to exalt. I don't want that. You could have it. I'd give it all to you in a second. But that's what God has for me, and that's what he has for you, and it's beautiful, and you don't get it, okay? So there's the rebuke, okay? In 11, therefore, all your company be gathered together against the Lord, for as Aaron, who is the one that you grumble against him? Okay, so they're gonna do this. And verse 12, he says, we will not come up. That's not Moses summoned these guys. Verse 13, it says, it's not enough for you to have brought us out of the land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us. Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us the inheritance of the fields and the vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. So Moses says, come on out. And they say, no, we're not going to. In fact, Moses, you haven't done what you promised to do. You said milk and honey. You promised us this land. You've done nothing. So like they're just... like, none of this is in his control anyway, right? And they just continue to pick on Moses saying, we're not going to do this, okay? Then God hears Moses' prayer in 15 and following. Yeah.
Did they know, how did they know that the Lord was speaking to Moses? Like, did they just believe that he was pulling out of nowhere?
That's a great question. It seems a little bit more direct than that. So I think when Moses went into the tabernacle, they would see some type of interaction similar to maybe as he was on the mountain and that interaction that they had. So I think it was a bit more apparent than Moses was like, okay, yeah, so, yeah.
I would say we saw in Exodus that he had to wear a veil because his face was shining. I'm wondering if that is a process that continued as he talked with the Lord.
And yeah.
And
this may have been an audible thing, right? I mean, he calls out Miriam and Aaron in their presence and is like, how dare you treat Moses like this? Like, you think, I talked to Joseph and Abraham through a dream. I speak to Moses face to face. The idea of, man, there's communication there, right? And at some point that changed. We don't see that today, but it very possibly could have been an audible voice. You know, I don't know. So those would have been the fun things just to be a fly on the wall that, you know, we don't get the parentheses. And, oh, by the way, here's how it happened. So... put that on the list of questions to ask God when we get there. I don't know that Ronan knows that either, but try. So,
how exactly did that work?
Okay. So they're ticked. Moses now prays, okay, and this is his prayer. This is stern, okay? Jane, pick up there in 15.
Then Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not accept their offering. I have not taken so much as a donkey from them, nor have I wronged any of them."
Okay, so what is Moses asking to begin with in that? Do not have regard for their offering. What does that mean? Don't forgive them. So don't take their offering. Your offering was what allowed you to be acceptable in front of God. So what ultimately is he saying? If that's what they want, and then don't accept their offering and let them have the consequences, because that is what they are asking for. And then what's his rationale? What does Moses point to? End of 15.
He was falsely accused by
them. Yeah, I'm a man of integrity. I've done nothing wrong, God. All I'm trying to do is follow you. I haven't taken from them. I haven't used them in any way, right? I've done everything right, okay? So he says now to the sons of Korah in 16 and following, present your offerings before the Lord. He walks through again what they are to do, okay? And in 18, they each took his own censer, put fire upon it. This is all the sons of Korah. Laid incense on it, and they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Okay, so here you go. So we've got the priest off right here. 19, this is what happens.
When Korah had gathered all his followers in opposition to them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, the glory of the Lord appeared to the entire assembly. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Separate yourselves from this assembly so I can put an end to them at once."
Okay, that's a good sign of what's to come, right? That's... move over a little, okay? Because it's about to get nasty, and you don't want to be anywhere near them. I mean, that's what he says. You're like, oh, okay, moving, right? So keep going.
But Moses and Aaron fell face down and cried out, "Oh God, God of the spirits of all mankind, will you be angry with the entire assembly when only one man sins?" Then the Lord said to Moses,
"Now pause for a second. What is Moses saying in that prayer? When one man sins, will you be angry with everybody?" Who's he calling out? Korah, right? So that's not the case in the sense that it's greater than that, but Moses is, he's pleading with God for grace, right? A minute ago, who's like, don't accept their offering in the sense that, you know, make sure that they understand who's in charge here, which is ultimately you, and they don't get to control you. But he's pleading now, even in the midst of this, for mercy for these people that are basically saying, "Moses, we hate you. We wish you'd die so that we can go back to Egypt." So, again, the character of Moses, you're like, man, you're unbelievable, right? Keep going.
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to the assembly, move away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and
Abiram."
Moses got up and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. He warned the assembly, "Move back from the tents of these wicked men. Do not touch anything belonging to them, or you will be swept away because of all their sins."
I mean, God's like, "Moses, go tell the people to get back, because it's about to get nasty." So he hears his prayer in the sense, and he's not going to kill everybody, thankfully, and that's right. But he's going to make sure that these people understand that this is how it works. They all got back, verse 27, around the dwellings of Korah from Dathan and Abiram. They came out and stood at the doorway of the tents along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. Okay? So keep that in mind. Okay? Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men," meaning if they die of natural causes, if they die like everyone else does, or if they suffer the fate of all men, "then the Lord has not sent me." Meaning, okay, if you guys just die in the wilderness like God said, I'm not the guy, you're the guy, okay? However, this is hilarious, and well, kind of, but I think it's funny. 30, this is Moses' suggestion.
"But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord."
I mean, have we ever seen God deal that way with people? You're like, where did Moses come up with this? Okay, we've seen like fireballs from heaven with Sodom and Gomorrah. We've seen plagues. God, open up the ground, swallow them all alive, and shut it up. Like, that's pretty crazy. So I think Moses is like, how clear can we get to make sure they understand the picture? And Moses just throws that out there in the midst of his conversation, okay? Then it came about, as he finished speaking these words in 31, that the ground that was underneath them split open, The earth opened its mouth, swallowed them up, their households, all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions, so that they all belonged that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol. The earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. Boom. Gone. I mean, like, are you kidding me? So, how'd the Priest-Off go? Not so good if you're a Korah, from Korah or one of his buddies, right? So there's 250 men, plus their wives, plus their children. So does a man's leadership in the family affect his kids? Unfortunately, these kids who, in every sense of the word, were innocent, they were underneath the headship of a disobedient father who said, the heck with God and the heck with what he wants. This is what I want. And God says, okay. You know, and he warned him and he gave him a chance. Okay, so tough. Okay. He's not done yet, by the way. Okay. All of Israel who were around them said, the earth may swallow us up as well. So, you'd probably be nervous after that. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. So just to make sure that there was a portion that were swallowed, and then God toasts these other 250 to be clear which group of people he had chosen, okay? Then the Lord spoke to Moses and said, say to Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, that he shall take upon censers out, take the censers out of the midst of the blaze, for they are holy, and you shall scatter the burning coals around. Do you have a question?
Yeah, didn't Moses ask God not to kill them?
Yeah. But God says they're guilty. So thank you, Moses. But no, I'm gonna go ahead and take care of this.
Not kill everybody.
Yeah, he's asking for the folks that are innocent not to be killed, and Moses is assuming that it's just Korah, maybe, that's leading this, and the other people aren't as wicked or involved. And God says, oh no, it's all of them.
Yeah, because when you show up with your family and stuff, that's, you know, to me, I read that and I'm like, yeah, they're bringing their family and everybody.
You're fully committed at that point, right? You think you're right and righteous, okay? You can just see the level of deception that these people are in, their lack of being able to see the truth. Now, this is fascinating. God says in 37, hey, by the way, there's nothing wrong with the utensils that these guys were using. They're holy, okay? The censers that the 250 men were putting their incense on, he says to the priest, go get those. We're going to use those. And he's gonna do something fascinating with these in 38. Read that.
As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, for they offered them before the Lord, and they became holy.
So what do they do with those, the fire pans? They plate the altar with them, right? So now the altar is plated in gold, okay? And that was a reminder to them that, listen, only the priests do this. Do not usurp the structure that God put in place. So Eleazar does that with the fire pans. They put them out as plating around the altar. In verse 40, it says, as a reminder to the sons of Israel that no layman who is not of the descendants of Aaron should come near to burn incense before the altar, that he might not become like Korah and his company, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. So God gives them a very clear audiovisual, a rock pile of remembrance, if you will, in a different sense, to say, don't forget this moment, okay? We're going to see a king in a few months that forgets this lesson hundreds and hundreds of years later, and he's going to walk into the sanctuary and say, I'm a king. I think I could be a priest as well. And God's going to say, let's see how this goes, right? Not going to go well. So
if Korah and all his descendants are gone now, who's in charge of them?
But we still have Levites, and apparently it's not all of them. It's Korah and members of his family, but we still have Kohathites left, apparently. So, and we still have a young generation, right? So these were all men from the 20 and up generation. So he didn't kill the whole family. It's just, it started with Korah.
And then his children too. So.
Yeah. So, but Korah's family, and he was one of the Kohathites. So he was a son. Anyway, so yeah, we still have Kohathites. We still got all those guys. But yeah, so fear not, okay? So 41, amazing, are you kidding me? Read this.
But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, you have killed the people of the Lord. And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covering it, and the glory of the Lord appeared.
Moses, this is all your fault. Are you kidding me that that is the response? Do you see where these people are? I mean, do you see where God's like, man, I can't do anything with you. You guys are an unbelieving, unrepentant generation. They see God swallow up the entire group of people, toast the 250, serves as a reminder of God is speaking audibly, and they're like, yeah, all that happened, but Moses, this is still your fault, right? Like, wow, okay? Now God's going to bring stage two, okay? Keep going there, Raymond.
And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment.
So God doesn't leave room for Moses to bargain at this point. He's like, move. And then it starts.
And they fell on their faces, and Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar and lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For the wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun.
Okay, so imagine this. Okay, you've got the tabernacle in the center. Okay, Moses and Aaron and God are having this conversation, and Moses basically is told by God, get out of the way, I'm bringing a plague. And literally, people just start dying all throughout the congregation. They're in the middle, right? Moses says, Aaron, grab your censer, because you were the right priest, get fire off the altar, and you are going to run into the congregation, and you are going to make atonement for the people. I mean, it's a crazy idea. So literally, he is just boom-chugga-lugging it out into the congregation. As this plague is coming from the outside in, he's going out to meet it, okay? And that's it. So, so he made incense. It's in the Hebrew. I studied this in seminary, people. Jeez. I may scrap that next time when I teach you. No boom chugga lugga lugga. All right, y'all didn't like that. All right, so verse 48, it's still good. Never mind me, just read the text, it's good.
So Aaron took it as Moses said and ran into the midst of the assembly, and behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people, and he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped.
It's a super powerful picture that when the right process is followed, when Aaron and Moses, who are trying to be as godly as they can, when they meet with the promised atonement of the shed blood of an animal, right, that had been already offered on the altar, and they meet with that deal, it literally is like the plague is coming in waves, and everyone in front of it is dead, everyone behind it is not yet, and Moses or Aaron brings this, and it stops right there. 14,700 people die just in that plague alone. Besides those who died on the account of Korah. So, crazy.
Was this God's way of trying to show the people that Aaron and Moses are on their side?
Absolutely. Like, God is trying to say as clearly as I can, and we're going to see it again in 7. The whole chapter 17 is, just in case you're unclear, like, who the priesthood is, it's them. Like, he's just, it's, yeah. So, they are your means to me. This is how I set it up. I don't really care if you don't like it. Isn't this fascinating that throughout history, man has never liked the idea of having to have a mediator to go before God? I'm sinless. I can do what I want. I don't need a go-between. There's nothing wrong with me. God says, oh no. Oh no. You need someone to stand in your place to do what you could not do to make you acceptable to me. And we do not, the pride in us says, I don't like that. And forever throughout history, people have never liked that idea of needing something done on their behalf because they can't do it themselves, right? It's just, it's always been the case. And it's the same picture today when you're trying to convince someone of their sinfulness and their need for a Savior. It's like, then that's great for you, right? Because you're weak. But I don't need that. So thank you. Right? So a little bit different deal. And again, we look back at these times, or at least I do, and think, man, if we just had some of these things, it'd be so clear. God shows them all this, right? I mean, audio, visual, that they've never seen before. Their hearts don't change a lick. Heart problems are heart problems, right? It's not, you can't fix it with a magic show. So, unfortunately.
No discussion.
Okay, so that's the idea, okay? 17, there you go. So there's 16, that ended, okay? So that is the climax of this whole rebellion thing, okay? So we're not gonna see high-handed rebellion like this again. We're gonna see people start dying, and now we're gonna start focusing on in a little bit more of the new generation. But in terms of leadership bowing up against Moses, we're not going to see it to this degree again. Okay, so as I look at it from chapter 11, this is the end result of what happened in 11. And it all started because some people on the outside said, man, where's our food? This stinks. It was way better off. Don't you think it was better off in Egypt? Yeah, I think it was better off in Egypt too. And all of a sudden, it creeps in, creeps in, creeps in, creeps in, till there is now a coup. And the vice president and the cabinet and the Senate are all like, you know what? Let's take this guy down. Okay. So remember that as you guys are leading groups of people. Okay. Bickering and little side conversations may seem insignificant. Oh, they are a cancer to an organization. A cancer. And they have to be rightly dealt with. Okay, so not prescribing that, you know, you ask for fireballs out of heaven or that God's going to do that, but a healthy organization has to have great ways to appropriately deal with frustration, right? I mean, at the well with 70 people and staff, right, there's always stuff. It happens, it's normal, and it's not bad, but there's a way to go about it that is healthy for an organization, and there's a way that's destructive. Okay, so that's just the reality of life. Okay, so speaking of validating the priesthood and making sure that people know who's who, that's what chapter 17 is, okay? Kind of an odd deal as to how God does this. But he says to Moses in verse 2 of chapter 17, speak to the sons of Israel, get from them a rod from each of their father's households. Okay, so 12 rods for each tribe and all their leaders according to the father's households, and you shall write the name on the rod, okay? So get one from Judah, get one from Reuben, get one from Gad, from Naphtali, all of them, okay, and Levi. So you got all the rods that are up there, write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there is a rod for the head of each of the father's households, okay? And he's going to do something with these rods just so they can see, again, this audiovisual. Yeah?
Would this be 13 then?
It does say 12, isn't that odd?
It does.
I don't know. Clearly we have Levi included. Yeah, so when you guys with Logos open, see if they speak to that issue, if there's anything on 17.2 as to why there's 12. So, or maybe they put Ephraim and Manasseh together. I don't know. But, yeah, it says 12s. And maybe it's 12 in addition to Aaron's, his being the third. I don't know. So, there you go. So, they're going to put them outside the tent of meeting in verse 14, okay? And then Moses puts them there before the tent of meeting in verse 7. Okay, the next day, Moses went out in verse 8 into the tent of meeting, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. So this stick now becomes a ripe almond tree, and all the rest of them did it. What is God showing there? Yeah, in the sense that, okay, that's the one. Now, why ripe almonds? Does that happen overnight? No, obviously. So it's a maybe a smaller miracle in the sense of like, ta-da! But it's like, no, that doesn't happen. God is choosing that, and he's making what happens normally over years immediately occur to show, that is my chosen instrument. So you got ripe almonds, which was a miracle, okay? Moses brought all the rods out from the presence of the Lord. They looked, and each man had his rod. But the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumbling. So where does that rod ultimately go? Into the ark, right? So you got the tablets. You've got now Aaron's budded rod with the almonds on it. And then ultimately we're going to see a jar of manna get put in there as well as a remembrance of their trip throughout the wilderness, okay? Moses did that, and then 12, this is the response of the people.
And the people of Israel said to Moses, behold, we perish, we are undone, we are all undone. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Are we all to perish?
It's kind of an odd response, and that's the end of the chapter, right? It's like, well, are you getting it that you're all going to die? Or are you just saying you're all going to die because you don't understand the system and that there's atonement made on your behalf? It's like, we're all going to die. This sounds like, again, this woe is me. I don't know. So it's an odd response without a lot of commentary with 17 ending there. Okay? So there you go. All right? So that's kind of the end of that section, if you will. Okay? Chapter 18 is, in a sense, more of a review of the job of the Levites. Okay, so he's reaffirming to now that, okay, are we clear that this is the right tribe? Okay, moving on. Let's remind you of your duties. So in 18, most of this is, again, it's just a reminder of what the Levites' job was. Okay, a couple things to take note of. In verse 20, we know this, but he tells them this again. The Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in the land, nor your own portion among them. I am your portion, your inheritance among the sons of Israel. So you don't get land, you get me. Okay? So he tells them that's the idea. When you go into land and he's going to scatter them abroad, it's not that they're being punished. It's that their portion is, in a sense, better because they get God and not a, you know, not acreage, if you will. And that's the kind of the cool piece of who they're going to be. Okay, look at 26 as well. Look at what he requires. I think we talked about this yesterday, but just fascinating that it's commanded here in verse 26.
Moreover, you shall speak and say to the Levites, when you take from the people of Israel the tithe that I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present a contribution from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe.
How about that? So what are the Levites required to do? Tithe, right? Are they an exception to the rule just because they're Levites? No. I don't care if you're Joe Blow or the senior pastor, right? Tithe. And it's a tithe of a tithe. Great. So you got paid. Your paycheck came from someone else's tithe, which is how everyone at the well gets paid. Then tithe the tithe, right? Tax the tax. We complain about that, right, all the time in that theory. But it's like, no, it's exactly what God calls them to do. You're no different. So you tithe. You show your faith. You as leaders, you go first, right? So it's kind of a cool observation that God says, listen, y'all give as well, okay? That can't change, all right? So chapter 19, this is the red heifer sacrifice, okay? We have mentioned we have a gazillion people dying, right? One every 8 minutes if they die just during daylight hours. The priests would be fairly busy dealing with dead bodies. So God comes up with a system called the red heifer sacrifice that allows the people to deal with the uncleanliness that is now going to be in their midst in a crazy way. Okay? Let's see. Let's pick up in verse 2.
This is the statute of the law that the Lord had commanded. Tell the people of Israel to bring you a red heifer without defect, in which there is no blemish, and on which a yoke has never come.
All right, so I'm a suburban kid. You guys all know what a heifer is. I didn't, okay? A heifer is a female cow that is never born young, okay? As well as, in this case, has never been yoked, okay? So it's never done any work. So this is a pristine cow. Younger, hasn't had calves yet, and has never been put into forced labor, okay? So he picks this for, I don't know what the symbolism per se, but that was the requirement for this sacrifice. Okay, you're going to give that to Eleazar. Okay, remember this is JB priest underneath Aaron. It shall be brought outside the camp and slaughtered in his presence. Okay, Eleazar in verse 4 shall take some of its blood on his fingers, sprinkle it around the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. The heifer shall be burned in his side, its hide and its flesh and its blood with its refuse shall all be burned. Okay, the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it into the midst of the burning heifer. Okay, this is odd. The priest shall wash his clothes and bathe his body. The one who burns in verse 8, burn it all shall wash his clothes and his body. Now the man who is clean shall gather up the ashes in verse 9, deposit them outside the camp in a clean place, and the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. Okay, so they take this concoction from this burnt heifer and the stuff that they put in it, take its ashes, mix it with water, and you basically have, for maybe lack of a better picture, holy water. Okay, so there's this vat of this mixed substance that God says this is going to be a piece of atonement. Okay, verse 11, the one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. Okay, verse 13, anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died and does not purify himself defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off. So you're unclean. Okay, but this concoction would allow you to become clean. Okay, verse 18. Watch kind of how this goes down.
Then a clean person shall take
hyssop,
yeah, and dip it in the water and sprinkle it on the tent and on all the furnishings and on on the persons who were there and on whatever touched the bone or the slain or the dead out of the grave.
Okay, keep going.
And the clean person shall sprinkle it on the unclean on the third day and on the seventh day. Thus on the seventh day he shall cleanse himself, and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and at evening he shall be clean.
All right, so what God is doing here is allowing a system where not just the priest now can clean other people, now it's everybody, okay, in only this instance. So he reaffirms the priesthood to say, hey, all of our sacrifices, they work the exact same way. But now as you're carting, you know, dead bodies out of your house, you're still unclean for 7 days, take this mixture, sprinkle it on you on the third day, on the seventh day. You know, your uncle can do it, your dad can do it, you, whatever. Okay, and now he's made a way for the congregation to still interact and worship and to not tax the priesthood to the point where they can no longer take part in their deal. Okay, we're going to have for sacrifice. Okay, so that is 19, the allowing of the people to cleanse themselves from impurities as a result of touching dead stuff, people or animals or otherwise. Okay, so 20. This is the tier chapter. Okay, this is where it gets bad for Moses. Okay, so sad. All right, let's pick up in 20 verse 1.
In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh, where Miriam died and was buried.
Okay, now, big picture, this is 40 years later, okay? So, we get the review of the journey in chapter 33. It'll say they camped here, and they went there, they went there, and went there. They move on average about one time a year. We see 41 different camps mentioned in chapter 33 in a 40-year period. Now, so average once a year. Again, we saw we have no idea when and how God's going to move. But chapter 20 occurs right at the end of this 40-year period. Okay, so 40 years in the desert, they've been enacting all these things. Old generation is dying off, and that's where they're at. Okay, Miriam dies of natural, causes at the end of verse 1. So she's gone. Love you, mean it, Miriam, but I'm not shed tears for you. Okay, verse 2, see if this sounds familiar.
Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, if only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord.
Doesn't this sound familiar? Like, wait a second. Like, this happened 40 years ago.
Is
like,
this the new generation?
This is, it's both, but yeah, the new generation is certainly a part of this. So the old generation isn't entirely dead at this point, but it seems like there's a bit of the new generation here as well, okay? Keep going.
Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grains or figs, grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink.
Man, like, same complaint 4 years later, right? Moses and Aaron came into the presence of the assembly, the doorway of the tent of meeting, fell on their faces, again, go to God. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 8, watch what he asked Moses to do. Dave, pick up there.
Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them, and give drink to the congregation and their cattle.
All right, so the last time Moses was to bring water out of a rock, how did he do it? What did God command him to do?
Did he hit it?
Hit the rock with your staff, and it's going to split open, and water's going to come out of the rock. This time, what does God say to do?
Speak to
the rock. Okay, so interesting little nuance, but God says you're going to do it different this time. This isn't a formula. I'm in charge. Speak to the rock and say, bring forth water. Okay, Moses took the rod before him just as God had commanded, so he's doing exactly what God commands him to do. Moses and Aaron gathered before the assembly, before the rock, and he said to them, this is what's odd. You've never heard Moses say this before. Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Moses lifted up his hand, struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. Now, what seems odd about that? He seems really mad, right? What was Moses' issue 80 years ago? What got him in trouble?
Temper.
His temper, right? You guys remember that? Mm-hmm. He killed a guy in the wilderness because he flew off the handle. Mm-hmm. There's a seed of that that's in here. Now, I don't think it's his temper that ultimately is why God says, you're done, okay? What else in the text do you see in Moses' response that bugs you?
It says, shall we for you? And, the whole time he's been pleading for them.
Yeah. So where does Moses point the finger? You want me to do this for you? Really? Me and Aaron? There you go. Jeez, people. Right? And what's God saying? Whoa. I'm in charge. I provide water. I take care of the congregation. Moses, you in that moment took glory away from me, and you pointed to the wrong person. You're on the bench. You have dishonored me in their presence. And as a result of that, you're on the bench, and you don't get to go in the promised land. Oh, man.
Does he kind of get higher standards, though, because he is such a leader?
Absolutely.
Like, it affects everyone.
Absolutely. Don't forget that. That is the unforeseen consequence, is the wrong word, but of being a leader. Is there a higher standard? Absolutely, right? I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day. He used to go to another church in town. He ran into a pastor at a restaurant in town, right? And he was at the bar with his wife having a glass of wine on a date, right? And as soon as this guy walked in, out of the corner of his eye, he immediately hands the drink to his wife. He's like, And my buddy was like, dude, I'm a farmer. I grow grapes. I make wine. Like, we're okay with that. But he had this moment of panic, right? Of like, oh gosh, I don't want anyone to see me. And as you talk to a lot of people that are in that role, they don't ever drink in public. They may feel the freedom to do it privately, which they certainly have that freedom, but a lot of pastors will not drink in public because it could cause someone to stumble. So I have to relinquish certain freedoms. Pastors feel that weight so that other people don't stumble, okay? And it's a hard call. There's not a right or wrong answer in it, but the reality is, there are certain restrictions that you just have to put on your life publicly so that you don't cause other people to gain, and it's just, is that fair? No. And you don't like it? Then don't be in that role, right? Are there certain things as a leader that you just can't do? Yeah, right? Can other people lose their temper every day for 40 years and not give glory to God and nothing happened to them? Maybe not nothing, but yeah, Moses does it one time. And God says, we can't do that, Moses.
When you say it might lead them to stumble if they saw a pastor drink or something like that, what does that mean?
Where I'm from, right, in the Bible Belt, drinking is a big issue. For whatever reason, it just is. And it's associated with a lack of godliness, and there's certain things that go with it that are associated with non-Christians. Right or wrong, it's just how drinking is perceived. And you go to Italy, right? Completely different. There is wine everywhere. I've never been, but the culture is different, right? You go outside the Bible Belt to California, alcohol is perceived differently, right? Even here, it's very, very different than, I've been on trips with people from our church, and man, they're opening up bottles of wine, and the presence of me, they don't have any problem with that, and nor should they. But in other contexts, they would have been really like, oh gosh, the pastor's here, can we have a bottle of wine, and we're not going to have seven, but, right, they would just felt, they handled it, right, it's just different. So sometimes there are certain issues in a culture that for whatever reason, are put wrongly on a pedestal that, man, you can't do these things. Man, you can go outside after church and smoke cigarettes till you're blue in the face. That's not the same as drinking, though. Like, really? But it's not in Texas. It just is what it is, right? So you have to be aware of those in leadership and figure out what those are. And right or wrong, it is what it is. So, I had a pastor that told me was when I was going through this program, he's like, man, the reality is you guys will never be able to have an alcoholic beverage in public ever again, ever. I can't sit with a member of the opposite sex at a restaurant or at Starbucks and have a counseling conversation, right? It just, you walk in and I'm sitting with some attractive member of the opposite sex at Starbucks, and what's the immediate thought? Is that okay? Like, I wrestled that, especially when I started a nonprofit. Like, I have to do that now. I had to talk with Michelle about it. Like, how do I handle that? And as much as it's up to me, I try to never meet with gals privately. It's not worth the whatever. So You know, and you look at someone like Brad or the rest of our pastoral staff, you won't, very rarely will you see that, if ever. Okay? And there's not a law, but like you just have to be aware of those things. It's not worth the potential fallout, even if it's a whatever, right? It's a perfectly harmless situation. Someone's meeting for a team or whatever, and Joe just hadn't gotten there yet. It's just those things that the higher you up the tree, the more people can see your rear end. And that's just the reality of it, right? So, Jeff, that was it.
Did I?
What? Yeah. So did you have a, I thought you were.
Oh, no, I don't talk. I'm
no.
Just over here.
That's right.
I don't think I've actually said anything this whole like semester,
so
yeah.
Well, you want to talk now for a little bit?
No, just
talk.
Thank you. I like it that I don't have to talk.
Okay. Well, that's cool, too.
I talk all day, so this is nice.
It's true. Your happy place? Okay. No more talking for you then. I don't want to worry you. All right. So let's stop here. We're over time. We will see you guys next week. Enjoy. We'll pick up on the rest of this next week. All right? Fabulous.